Marion.
Right. Ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not all that ready. I've looked over this list of questions again, and we haven't given them as much thought as they deserve. Each one really could be the subject for a whole essay.
Well,
that's the problem, but what I think I probably should do is simply sort of think out loud about each one, and you can sort of then paraphrase what I've said in the, you know, in the printed version of the interview.
Uh-huh. And then also, when I send you the final copy, you know, the final draft, if you think of something else you want to add, you can just write it in there.
Oh, sure.
So,
yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, I'm bound to have certain afterthoughts. Okay, now this number one here, say many people agree that the average IQ difference between blacks and whites probably has a genetic component. I'm glad you put the word probably into that, because this still isn't completely settled, and it's true that something like 50 or slightly more percent of persons who have some qualifications in this area claim that they believe that a genetic component is probably involved, but no one really knows, and the reason we don't know not because we don't want to talk about it or anything, but because there seems to be no scientific method available at the moment for settling this question that would be acceptable, that could be actually feasibly done, would involve cross-mating of random samples of the two racial populations and then cross-fostering of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be able to settle the issue as well as it could be settled, and that standard experimental design that's been used in agricultural genetics, but of course it can't be done with human populations because you would have to have some way of enforcing perfectly random samples of the two populations and getting people to cooperate in such a thing. That's just not at all feasible and would be ethically unacceptable to most people. Now, they say it's more kind and prudent. These people feel that it's more kind to blacks and more prudent generally in the sense of avoiding dissension and violence to maintain the illusion that the difference is all due to prejudice and other environmental factors. Well, it's very doubtful that it's due to prejudice. It's almost certainly not the explanation. And all of the popular environmental explanations are probably wrong or at least inadequate. They simply don't do the job. But that doesn't rule out as yet unknown environmental factors that may have some biological basis. Various kinds of nutritional factors and factors that haven't been very thoroughly taken into account, such as children born to teenage mothers and so forth and start life out with a kind of a prenatal and perinatal environmental handicap that hasn't been adequately assessed in its effects. Although the perinatal study is a collaborative study that studied prenatal and perinatal factors in IQ, don't find anything very dramatic among some 60 different factors that have been investigated along these lines, connected with prenatal condition of the mother, diseases, health factors, smoking, all kinds of things like that, and the perinatal things, that is, child's health and conditions of birth and so forth, don't seem to have any very large effect on IQs of children, and probably don't have much of an effect on the mean difference between blacks and whites. So the very little is known about what environmental factors, if any, are really responsible for the black-white difference.
But haven't a lot of people tried real hard for a long time to establish the existence of, you know, environmental influences and failed? I mean, it seems like...
Well, they keep trying on the same few few obvious sorts of differences that do not explain this, and they simply persist in repeating those rather than in investigating further aspects of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't really looked at everything, probably, or not very thoroughly at biological aspects of the environment.
Uh-huh.
They keep talking about white racism doing this, but without being able to explain the mechanisms by which it would lower IQ and all of its correlates. And they talk about socioeconomic status, and it's a very important finding. That I may be responsible for this finding, that the pattern of differences across various tests, see, blacks and whites don't differ the same amount on every kind of test, that the pattern of differences is different for upper and lower class persons within either the black or the white group than it is between the two groups. In other words, you can't explain the pattern of black-white differences on various tests in terms of socioeconomic status differences.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, well, I'm not quite sure what you're saying, but, for example, like, verbal ability maybe would be more highly correlated with social class, and spatial ability would not be so much, and then
the black-white difference in verbal ability, after you get rid of the general ability factor, is absolutely nil.
Right, right.
And yet there remains a sizable difference in spatial ability. And social classes within a racial group do not show very large differences in spatial ability, really none, after G is taken out.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of thing that shows that the black-white difference is something different from the social class difference we observe. There are other factors involved in it. There are some common factors, general factors involved in both social class differences and racial differences. But, of course, the general factor is not a causal thing. It's something that itself is caused and is in need of explanation. But I think that the dogmatic environmentalist stance and a dogmatic hereditarian stance has really prevented detailed research on environmental factors in the black-white difference. The people haven't really taken a close scientific look at this, strange as it may seem.
Well, I'm just wondering what...
The two sides of the argument has simply assumed a position that sort of rules out the necessity for further research on it.
Well, I'm just curious, I mean, do you have any specific things in mind when you talk about possible biological factors that would be environmental? I mean, obviously if somebody gets hit on the head real hard, that's not good, or if somebody has encephalitis, that could cause a loss of IQ, but what kind of biological factors?
For example, blood incompatibilities between mother and child. The kinds of factors that lead to fetal loss.
Uh-huh.
We know that there's a high rate of fetal loss in among blacks. This is true even in middle-class blacks, not among lower-class blacks, but among middle-class blacks with good jobs, college education, and so on. There's a higher rate of fetal loss than there is in the white or Asian population.
Well,
now, if fetal loss is a continuous variable, then it may be that some children are born with a certain amount of damage that's less than fatal.
Mm-hmm.
This may be related to lower abilities.
Well, could this have something to do with the fact that blacks have, I think the average is, 20% white genes in this population in the United States? I mean, could that have something to do with this business?
That could have something to do with it. It hasn't really been looked at carefully. But, for example, we know there's fetal loss in the case of Rh factor incompatibility within any race. mother and the fetus are incompatible in Rh factor. The fetus undergoes some damage, so that the children are fetuses that are the second or third pregnancy of a woman, where there's an incompatibility, where there's been previous incompatibility. These fetuses are at risk, and of course, this happens when the mother is has one Rh factor and the father has a different one, and the baby has a combination that's incompatible with the mother's. If the mother's Rh negative and the baby's Rh positive, I think that's the combination that leads to trouble. The mother builds up antibodies against the child. So stillbirths are much higher in second and third born children of mothers who have this incompatibility with their fetus on this particular one blood factor. Now, that hasn't been investigated with respect to black-white differences, but this could be a continuous variable and could lead to some subtle damage that would lower IQ by 1 or 2 points, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a number of these kinds of very small micro-environmental effects operating, it could have a considerable effect of lowering the IQ in one whole population if more of those factors are operating in that population.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these kinds of things still have to be looked at. I'm fairly convinced that some part of the black-white difference is tied in with biology, but whether it's genetic biology or indirect effects of genetics, such as blood type incompatibilities, teenage pregnancies, children get off to a poorer start, and I don't just mean a poorer start in a cultural sense, I mean in a biological sense, and so on and so on, that all of these could be some appreciable part of this difference that we see between the average black and the average white.
But it seems like the people who focus on environmental aspects, they don't ever think about biological things. You know, they just think about the social aspects. So
that's right, yes. And I think that has had a dampening effect on adequate research in this area. That simply by giving these the same old explanations over and over again that have actually been disproved, or giving explanations which cannot be scientifically tested, like saying that it's due to white racism without specifying any mechanisms by which white racism could be measured or adequately defined or how it could affect mental development, they simply cut off all further attempts to search the environment for possible causes.
Well, I think it was, I'm not sure, but I think it was Dick Lynn who wrote an article that said something to the effect that you don't have white racism if you have all blacks, you know, like in Africa. And so, I mean, you know, I'm not really too familiar with what has been done in terms of IQ testing in Africa, but I mean, my you know, superficial understanding is that the IQs of blacks in Africa are considerably lower than they are in the United States.
I don't put much stock in those arguments. It may be true and it may not be true. I simply don't know as though we have the means for assessing the intelligence levels of persons whose environments have been so extremely different from that of the environments of the white persons who were tested.
You see
what I'm saying? I mean, if you go to the Africans who have not been in contact with white culture, I'm not sure that we have any means at present of testing those people that makes their scores validly comparable with the scores of Europeans or whites in America or blacks in America.
Yeah.
Now, if one had some kind of physiological measures that are correlated with intelligence, it would be interesting to see what those are, evoked potentials and so forth, in black Africans.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you're talking about black Africans who are capable of taking our tests on a
Yeah, no, it is kind of a mess, or at least it didn't seem exactly rigorous, you know, what I've read about it.
Well, that's putting it mildly. And so until someone can develop techniques that measure some components of intelligence, what we call intelligence, at a physiological level, I don't think there's much we can do with persons who haven't been brought into the culture in which the kinds of tests we use can be regarded as appropriate. And that even applies to, you know, purely nonverbal tests like Raven's matrices and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know just what environmental factors influence those kinds of tests. The fact that they're nonverbal doesn't mean that they're not in some way experientially loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, if one could do an experiment, if one could take a group of black Africans and right at birth and adopt them into white homes someplace, one would have a better chance of assessing this kind of thing. And there have been a couple of such adoption studies, and the results are extremely ambiguous because of all kinds of methodological problems, of selection of the adoptees, self-selection of the subjects who agree to participate in the study, so on.
Mm-hmm.
And one can draw very few scientifically worthy conclusions from any of those studies, one direction or the other. But the rather disturbing fact is that by lining up with one side or the other on this nature-nurture argument about black-white differences, one really subverts research in this area. I've seen as the greatest single obstacle to research in this area people who too readily assume one position or the other and give superficial explanations for their stance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how little interested those people are in actually researching this topic. There's probably less research interest in this topic than just about any other topic in psychology. And
it's probably
minds are so already made up and polarized that they're not interested in looking much further.
Yeah, it's probably, I don't know which is more unpopular, that or the whole business of IQ and fertility. That's another unbelievably unpopular, you know, area. Because
yeah,
people just don't want
to... Yeah, that's unpopular too, and it's related to this, of course. But we may get to that in a later question where this comes up. But now you ask, what harm is there in soft peddling this question? That is, by simply maintaining the illusion that all is due to prejudice or other superficial, I'll say, environmental factors that have really been ruled out on pretty strong scientific grounds. Scientifically, the greatest damage that's done by this is that each lie, you might say, or each myth that you try to sustain has to create other myths. It becomes an ever-expanding network of myths that have to be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
One has to sustain the myth of culturally biased tests.
Mm-hmm.
And the myth of, say, some kind of unconscious prejudice on the part of teachers where you can't find any evidence, any visible evidence at all of any prejudice on the part of the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And just one thing after another, and each of these items then generates further myths and so on, and you can trace them that they ramify into very distant areas. It's a very subtle, in a sense, pollution of the whole of the behavioral sciences by this particular issue.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it, actually. I mean, it's interesting.
And then the other harm in it is a kind of social harm in that as long as you don't actually get at the facts of the case and simply work on myth, you're powerless to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the myths don't have any leverage in reality. And so they leave you with nothing to do about the situation. And they also can lead to a kind of social paranoia. I'm reminded of attending a Berkeley School Board meeting once when, after the first several years of school integration and so forth, and practically all of the black-white gap in its scholastic achievement that Berkeley claimed on segregated schools, and this was about 5 or 6 years after the schools had been completely desegregated by two-way busing. And they had a school board meeting, and the director of research for the school system showed slides and presented the test results, and they were no different than they were before segregation.
Mm-hmm.
Before desegregation.
Right.
And one black woman stood up in the audience and said, "Well, why is it? How do you explain that? Is there something wrong with the test?" And the man said, "No, the tests are a fair measure of a scholastic achievement. Reading comprehension, arithmetic, and things like that." And the mother says, "Well, then, why is it? I mean, why are our children doing so much more poorly? You told us that desegregating the schools would do it. What is wrong with the schools?" So on. And he said, "I don't know," and sat down. And so I think this generates a feeling that there's something going on in the white establishment, you might say, that's inimical to the success of blacks in the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can see it where if you're told that it's not because of anything that can't be seen and controlled, such as racism in the, among the teachers and so on, then they begin to believe it's some secret kind of conspiracy. That someone's got to be to blame for it.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than cause may lie in past evolution or something, you see. It may be an extremely remote set of causes that's responsible for the differences we now observe.
Well, hasn't the performance of Oriental children sort of thrown a wrench into the whole business about, you know, prejudice and the tests are biased because they were made by whites and so on and
right,
so on. I mean,
how can
somebody explain the fact that the Chinese and Japanese and Vietnamese children do so remarkably well, and a lot of times, you know, like, a lot of these children came to the United States without, they didn't have a penny, they couldn't speak the language. You know, and in a few years they were winning prizes and stuff.
That's right, yes. It's interesting that the recent National Spelling Bee contest, that the winner and the first runner-up were both Asians. One was an Indian, and one was born in India, in fact, and the other was Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And they're such a small minority in the total population, yet they win things like this. Well, I think all of these things certainly make it difficult for the usual popular environmental explanations of the black-white gap. But I'm not sure there's much more I can say on that particular point. I believe that the Asians may be somewhat resented now by certain groups, including white groups, mainly because of their rather conspicuous success. I mean, you know, there's some commotion at the University of California now, and in the state legislature, over the fact that such a high proportion of California high school graduates who are qualified to enter Berkeley are Asians.
Mm-hmm.
That there's even been talk of changing the admissions
how could they...
By putting in other requirements other than academic achievement and high test scores and that sort of thing. Or, you know, extracurricular sports activities and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been protests in the Asian community against doing that sort of thing, of course. But the Asians are highly overrepresented in the colleges and universities in California. And they're, of course, highly overrepresented in classes for the gifted in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
They are only about 2% of the general population, but they're about 20% of the population of gifted classes.
Yeah, that's interesting. I knew they were overrepresented, but that's quite a bit.
Oh, it's a lot, yes. Now, they're very overrepresented in membership in, say, the National Academy of Sciences. They're overrepresented by a factor of 10 for their numbers in the population. National Academy of Sciences, which is the group of about 1,000 most elite scientists in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And both Jews and Asians are highly overrepresented in the membership of any such organization as that, which is based on a very high degree of selection for intellectual accomplishments. Okay, shall we go on to number 2?
Okay.
Let's see. I said, in the module book, I wrote, any prescription with eugenic overtones is almost certainly doomed for the 20th century, and one can only speculate about conditions in the 21st century that may bring about a change on this issue. You asked what I should speculate about these conditions and about what eugenicists might do to hasten process along. Well, I think there are the two kinds of catastrophes that may result in a changed attitude about eugenics that may actually make some eugenic measures a necessity. One is something that no one would wish for and that we are all working toward not happening, and that is some kind of a nuclear holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been suggested by others, this is my own idea, I simply read it other places, that if there were a nuclear holocaust, the fallout from it would be such that there would be a great many genetic mutations, and there would be so many children born with birth defects and so forth, that it would be necessary, just as there were after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombing. There were a great many children born who were, for example, microcephalic imbeciles.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. There would be so much of that worldwide from nuclear fallout that it would be the governments that are set up, they wouldn't be the governments that still exist in all probability, and the world would be so disorganized that new governments would have to be formed. But the governments that did exist would probably have to institute certain kinds of eugenic laws about who couldn't breed and sterilization of people who have produced children who were defective and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And sterilization of defective persons as a result of these genetic mutations, because it would be almost inhumane to try to maintain them in a world that was as upset by all of this as it would be. I mean, the facilities for taking care of that many disabled, genetically disabled persons would be impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And because eugenic measures would have to be taken very seriously then, it would be probably instituted by all governments that wanted to take care of their people. That would be a kind of, it would kind of break the ice, you might say. Now, that's one scenario we hope will never occur. The other scenario that seems to me is virtually bound to occur is the one of population pressure, particularly in undeveloped nations. population since it gained independence in 1947.
Uh-huh.
At that time, it had a population of something like 350 million, and now it's pushing 700 million, maybe slightly over that now even. This kind of population pressure is going to finally cause governments to do what China is doing. Of course, only a totalitarian government at present could do this. But it may be that other governments that are not totalitarian are going to see the necessity for doing this just in order to preserve a reasonably decent standard of living for the majority of people in the country. And first of all, this is going to have eugenic effects. One can be quite sure that the limitation on family size that is now being enforced in China will have eugenic effects, positive eugenic effects. Due to the differential birth rate as one goes from the low to the high end of the ability spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't know much about this in China. I'm not aware of any research that's been done there, but in all countries where this has been researched, it's found that persons who marry or mate without the benefit of marriage, either one, who are in the lower half of the IQ distribution, particularly in the lower fourth, that would be IQ below 90, tend to have larger families than persons in the upper quartile
mm-hmm.
of the distribution.
Mm-hmm.
A fewer of them marry, but the ones who do, or mate, but the ones who do have larger families.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you restrict family size throughout the population uniformly, then there will be a more optimal balance between the high end and the low end of the, what you might call the IQ distribution.
But it seems like that would be eliminating a dysgenic situation, but you wouldn't actually, I mean, you would just be breaking even if everybody had the same number of children, wouldn't you?
We're breaking even as it is. So you would actually have a eugenic situation. We seem to be breaking even, at least within the white population, studies show, because as you go below average IQ on down toward the low end, the percentage of people who have any children at all decreases. But those who do have children have more children than do people in the upper half of the distribution.
So you're
more
saying,
of whom have children, but fewer of them.
Right. But I'm going to have to take issue with you on that point. Because, you know, my research when I was at the University of Texas on IQ and fertility covered, I guess it was from 1894 to 1984, something like that, almost 100 years. And, you know, it was a huge sample, and they had this little bitty IQ test, but for statistical purposes it was useful. And, you know, there were, out of all the, I think it was 15 cohorts, almost every single one was statistically significant negative correlation, with the exception of the baby boom generation, which had a zero, you know, just about a zero correlation between fertility and intelligence. And the baby boom generation was the main one that all these people, I can't even figure the names, Reed and, you know, Bajima, I think, did a study, and some other people, but that's the generation that most of those people focused on, and also they didn't have really representative samples. And so the conclusion that I came up with was that since, you know, for this whole century, you know, up to the present, there's been a negative correlation almost, you know, the whole time. And the and I somehow managed to disprove this business of the really stupid people, you know, sometimes not marrying and not having any children. That was the case in one study that was done around the Great Lakes. I can't remember whose study it was because it's been so long. But that's not, you know, they said, oh, we've got the answer to this paradox. And, you know, and it seemed plausible. But, they're wrong. I can't quite, you know, it's been so long since I've thought about this, I can't quite remember
right.
why they're wrong.
Yeah, you may be right on that. I'm just not sure. I know I'm familiar with your article on that. One thing that's sort of a mystery in this field right now is why there seems to be this secular increase in IQs on both, you know, verbal or culture fair sorts of tests, as well as the verbal tests and more culturally loaded tests. In fact, it seems to be the tests like Raven's matrices, the nonverbal and so-called culture fair tests, culture reduced tests, that show the largest increases in average scores over the last couple of generations.
Well, I'm just, you know...
Do you have any ideas about that?
The only thing I can think of is that you have said, and this is seems absolutely reasonable, that the G is a dominant trait. And, you know, I think you had an article about spatial ability where cousins, cousin marriages showed an increase in spatial, so that therefore we think that's recessive. But I mean, general intelligence is dominant. So I mean, the more, the greater increases in transportation and communication and so on means there's going to be more, like, outbreeding, I guess you might say. And so the extent to which it's dominant, you know, I mean, this would,
I think it may be related to whatever the factors are that have caused this secular increase in height.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And rate of maturation.
Mm-hmm.
These things have been going on over the same period of time, and it may be the same biological factors, because they seem to affect the whole population quite uniformly.
But the thing, okay, let me ask you, what about the decline in SAT scores? Do you attribute that solely or partially or what to the fact that they're trying to make everybody stay in school, and a lot of people are taking the test nowadays who would have just dropped out long before.
Right.
Is that the cause for that?
A large part of it is due to that, but this so-called Blue Ribbon panel that was appointed to investigate it, and it had some very competent psychometricians on it, found that some small part of the variance, the lowering of SAT scores, could not be explained by that factor. But I think it may simply be changes in the composition of the population. That is, what have been the birth rates and so forth in different segments of the population that take the SAT? These intergenerational changes are changes that take place, you know, over between decades, can simply reflect slight differences in the composition of the population.
But what I can't understand is how can you reconcile that with Lynn's stuff about how we're supposed to be, you know, having an increase in intelligence? It just doesn't seem to make sense unless you say that it's all because more people are taking the test who wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, of course, the total population isn't taking the SAT. It's some rather select part of the population. It's a fairly large proportion of high school graduates, but it's certainly not a representative sample of the total population. That may be part of the explanation. And also, the SAT is heavily educationally loaded, so the kinds of things that are stressed in school and the kinds of demands that are made by schools in order to get through would be reflected in SAT scores more than in most IQ scores.
I see. So, I mean, in other words, a decline in education...
Right.
It would be sufficient to explain that.
Yes, education watered down to accommodate a larger number of persons getting through, and so on, standards lowered, grade inflation, and all of that sort of thing, so that something like 40 to 50% of the population can go on to college because they're high school graduates, then the educational standards are lower and so forth. And it may be that the top achievers even are not achieving as much as they did at some other time in our history,
mm-hmm.
simply because the demands on them are not as great.
Mm-hmm.
I know of cases where children have switched from one school system to another, and the smart, depending largely on the nature of the population in the area served by those school systems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can just say, like myself, I went to a public school for most of my life, and then I went, in high school, I went to a private school, and it was just like, I mean, it was just, it was such a difference that it was just unbelievable.
Right.
You know.
Well, people have noticed that in going from big city schools to suburban schools, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That the standard of achievement expected in one place is very different from that in another. And the children simply have to work much harder, do more homework, and take their studies much more seriously and read books at a higher reading level and so on.
Well, let me ask you one other thing about this Flynn business. Is he the only person who's got a hold of all these, I mean, of all these, you know, data, or is this stuff accessible to anybody who wants to get a hold of it?
Well, I think practically all of it's accessible to anyone who wants to get a hold of it. It's such a Herculean job to do what he's done with the data, however, that I doubt if anyone has or will reanalyze these data in the way he has to see if they come out with the same conclusions.
Yeah.
I'm in fairly close touch with him. I've corresponded with him fairly regularly over the last 2 or 3 years. In fact, I just got a letter off to him this week. He's still looking for more data, and he writes to me for data. I just recently sent him data that I got from the Berkeley School and the Bakersfield School. I don't know what he's going to do with it, but he seems to me to be an honest investigator, and in his big article in the Psych Bulletin, he gives references to all of his data sources, and presumably anyone else who wanted to could go out and dig those up. I myself was one of the referees on that article. And I, of course, didn't feel inclined to go out and redo all of the research he had done. It would take you 4 or 5 years to dig into all that material the way he has done. So a referee simply takes his word for it, and one does that in refereeing nearly any kind of an article. And I didn't find anything methodologically wrong with
mm-hmm.
what he had actually done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how select his data are, I don't know. He claims he's taken all of the data that are available for this kind of research. That is something I likelihood, yeah, that there's some kind of sampling problem. There may even be differences in the laxness with which tests are given over time. It may be that teachers and so forth took tests less seriously in recent years than they did earlier. And this could affect level of performance. For example, not observing time limits strictly and so forth. But of course, much of the data that he's based this on are standardization data put out by the test publishers themselves. And they have usually given the tests under very rigorous conditions.
Yeah, it just seems, I don't know, I guess until you really get into it, you just have no way of knowing, you know,
that's right.
what
I
might
think
be
that he is going to have to come up with some kind of explanation for this. He can't just throw it out there and expect others to explain it, because he's on top of the data and is in a better position to try to find an explanation. Now, I doubt very much that the differences he's finding in some places, such as in Holland, represent real differences in basic intelligence.
It's hard to believe. Actually, I think you wrote somewhere, maybe in this latest book, that if people were that much smarter than their parents, I mean, somebody would notice it.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
it would be noticeable. Right.
I mean, it's just too big of a jump to say, you know, in society, there would be many, you know, many different things where it would come out. Or teachers who are kind of old, they would think, wow, look at these new kids. They're just,
well,
you know.
Well, that's right. See, I've been a professor at Berkeley for 30 years now, and the students now aren't one whit smarter than they were 30 years ago. I saved a lot of exams from 30 years ago, and I've known a lot of students. I've read a lot of dissertations. I've been on a lot of oral exam committees and so on, and I can't see any real change in the student's ability level between then and now.
And also, it just seems intuitively implausible. Maybe this is not a good, maybe this is, doesn't constitute a reason for anything, but I mean, just looking around at the miserable mess that things are in, you just think to yourself, if all these people are so much smarter than their ancestors, my God, those people, how did they even manage to, you know, put their shoes on and make it to work in the morning?
Well, that's right, yes. Well, I don't think Flynn himself believes that these changes in test scores reflect real changes in intelligence. And I think that the point toward which his research is converging, in his opinion, is to discredit confidence in the test scores so that we do not have any confidence in the fact that the black-white difference in test scores has any real meaning.
I see. That's
his
interesting.
That's a basic argument,
I think.
That's what he wants to accomplish.
But it also has another effect, which I consider, you know, deleterious, and that is, I am worried about the relationship between intelligence and fertility considered as a whole, you know, the black population, the white population, I mean, just,
right.
And so if people think that, well, for some reason or another, actually we're getting smarter, then any dysgenic trend is going to be dismissed and not
right.
taken seriously. So I mean, what he's doing, I don't know, for a long time it's kind of worried me. Well, let's see, we've strayed a little bit.
Yeah, we've gotten off on to subjects that are not contained in the question.
But that's okay. See, I'll just put it all together and it'll work out great,
yeah.
I'm sure.